hppodcraft.com.
The idea that the extraordinary narrative, which is being called the Joyce Armstrong fragment, is an elaborate practical joke evolved by some person cursed by a perverted and sinister sense of humour, has now been abandoned by all who have examined the matter. The most macabre and imaginative of plotters would hesitate before linking his morbid fancies with the unquestioned and tragic facts which reinforce the statement. Though the assertions contained in it are amazing and even monstrous, it is nonetheless forcing itself upon the general intelligence that they are true, and that we must readjust our ideas to the new situation. This world of ours appears to be separated by a slight and precarious margin of safety from a most singular and unexpected danger. I will endeavour in this narrative, which reproduces the original document in its necessarily somewhat fragmentary form, to lay before the reader the whole of the facts up to date, prefacing my statement by saying that if there be any who doubt the narrative of Joyce Armstrong, there can be no question at all as to the facts concerning Lieutenant Myrtle, R.N., and Mr. Hay Connor, who undoubtedly met their end in the manner described.
That is the opening of The Horror of the Heights, a tale by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, a very Lovecraftian story that we are going to cover here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at hppodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
And who was that lovely human being we just heard reading?
That reader is one of our favorite Englishmen, John Hancock.
Yay!
John does a lot of awesome stuff, but one thing he does that I think is cool is he records live role-playing games, you know, tabletop role-playing games. Mm-hmm. He's got a heck of a voice, as you can hear, and hearing him play characters, he's very clever and very witty, and he's a really talented guy. So if you like that kind of thing, we'll put a link to it in our show notes, and you can check it out.
I've been tripping out on audience feedback lately.
Oh, yeah?
There are so many people who are writing him with story recommendations.
Yes.
Do this, do that. It's awesome, man. Like, please keep doing it. This whole month has been completely determined by what we've heard from folks.
Yep.
They said, do this story. We said, we will. And we want more of that.
This story was recommended to us by Caleb Shoggoth Lord Long. And I think he did a great job because this story is very Lovecraftian.
It is. And a friend of the show, Patton Oswalt, wrote about this story I saw online. He wrote, Arthur Conan Doyle writing a horror story. And what's more, it's a big honking flying monster story. Well, yeah. And it works.
Yeah.
The creator of Sherlock Holmes is channeling Lovecraft here, but where Lovecraft suggests, Doyle likes to be plausible, but explicit. Gon Wilson, in his introduction of the story, says you'll think about this on your next transatlantic flight and look up. So many times when I've been on an airplane and we've entered one of those huge but enclosed canyons of clouds, I thought of this. Long before I ever read this story, and Doyle brought my suspicions to life. To horrible, bloated life. By the way, I looked up Gon Wilson because I didn't know who that was.
Uh-huh.
And I actually did because I've seen his art before. And it's a rabbit hole that is definitely worth going down.
Oh, okay.
It's G-A-H-A-N.
And if you are listening to us talk about this right now, you're a subscriber.
That's right.
And I want to say thank you for subscribing.
Thank you so much.
We not only appreciate it, we would not be doing this show if you weren't supporting us. So thank you.
We're in the process of making the site better, actually, right now.
We are.
We are investing in it. We're doing it. It's going to be an outlet for all your pleasures. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is a kind of a high bar to set there, Pfeiffer.
It
I
is.
Don't know.
I'm doing it. I'm saying it now. All your pleasures.
Okay, let's just go there. It is like riding on the back of a pegacorn over a field of wishes.
Mm.
It will be.
And those wishes become miracles.
Thank you.
So let's come back to it. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, we know him from Sherlock Holmes, but apparently he had some monster-y ideas in his head.
Yeah.
And that's how we get to the story.
The story starts off talking about this Joyce Armstrong fragment. Most seem to think it's a joke, but the narrator proposes that it is for real.
Right. It's this fragment that's fallen to Earth.
The fragment was found around Upper Kent in England by a farmer. He found some broken binoculars and a canvas book that was some kind of journal. The first few pages were missing and the last page was torn out. The farmer realized it must have belonged to a pilot and brought it to the Aero Club in London.
Right. And I understand why they would think it was a hoax, because just you know, you find something someplace, it doesn't mean that this actually happened. But it suggested to me, you know, Nine Inch Nails, you've heard of this band. Early on in their career, they were filming...
Why? You know, I know Nine Inch Nails. I've listened to Pretty Hate Machine.
I'm trying to be like a TV host here, you know.
Many times in your presence.
Well, when they were shooting their video for one of their original things, they put a camera up on balloons. Uh-huh. And it was on a tether. You know, it showed Trent Reznor getting murdered in some gratuitous way. But the tether broke, and so the camera just flew off. And somebody found it and thought it was a snuff film, you know, and turned it in. They turned it into the FBI. And so they investigated this thing and they finally identified that it was Trent Reznor. It wasn't, you know, anything real.
Right.
That's what I thought about at this point in the story. Just because there's this journal here in the brush doesn't mean that this actually happened.
No.
It could very well be a music video prop.
Yes, in the early 1900s, of course.
Exactly.
So the journal belonged to Mr. Joyce Armstrong, a pilot who went missing. They call him an aeronaut, which I guess was the term at the time, which is pretty cool.
It is.
Flight was still in the early stages, so there was this level of exploration involved. This story was first published in the Strand magazine in 1913, so this was new stuff that was going on.
Yeah.
Armstrong was a wealthy guy who spent a lot of his time and money on planes. He was missing, and the last part of his journal seemed to be hastily written as if he was writing it in the plane as it was flying. Also, there was blood found on the journal as well. Forensics told them that it was human blood, and it also belonged to somebody that had malaria. And Armstrong was known to have at least once had malaria.
I liked this about what they found. It said, there are, it may be added, several stains, both on the last page and on the outside cover, which have been pronounced by the Home Office experts to be blood, probably human, and certainly mammalian. I like that phrase because it suggests... What, did a lizard knock the plane down? Or, you know, it's excluding. It's certainly mammalian.
Well, I think also the technology at the time, that was the best they can do with blood.
You know, yeah.
They didn't really do blood types. I'm trying to remember by 19. I'm talking on my rear here.
I don't know, but I think as far as writing goes, it's cool because it tells you. We're considering everything.
Of course. Yeah. So our guy Armstrong was a smart fellow, an inventor and a mechanic and explorer at heart.
It says a poet and a dreamer, as well as a mechanic and an inventor. What a great description of your character. I just wish I was that guy. I feel like, you know, I'm going to have an obituary and it's going to be like, he grew up, he liked monsters, he talked a bunch, dead.
It's never too late, Pfeiffer.
Just start, I know.
Start poeting and start dreaming.
Build a jetpack.
Well,
You've got to invent stuff, too. That's part of it.
Yeah, well, take some courses over at the community college and, you know, automotive repair, and then make some crazy thing, and then you're an inventor. Done.
Wouldn't that be great? Even if you didn't do it, you know, nobody could dispute it. Like, if you actually never invented anything... But if you put under your name on your tombstone, inventor, in about 100 years, nobody would know the better.
Nobody would know. Man, that's a morbid thing, but I like hanging out in Haworth. And there's that cemetery over there by the Parsonage Museum. My boys like chickens. Somebody's got chickens nearby there. So we hang out in the cemetery a lot with my children. It's pretty creepy. But we look at the tombstones. And I mean, some of those are hundreds of years old.
Right.
And it's strange to think about how the stone is already wearing away and some of them are totally illegible. Those people are long forgotten.
Oh, absolutely.
As in who they were. It seems like a stone thing is very permanent. I mean, I'm talking some Ozymandias kind of stuff here.
That's exactly it.
But nothing is permanent. Everything is changing all the time. And just deal with it.
Deal with it, but doesn't that make you sometimes feel a little liberated? It really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I totally took my clothes off the other day, ran down the street.
Why does it go to that?
Because I felt free, you know? It's like, it's not going to matter in 100 years, so who cares?
When I meditate on death, the opposite of that is you taking your clothes off. Just dancing.
Dancing to the Rite of Spring.
What are we talking about? What's going on?
I don't remember. Some guy in a plane. This guy, Armstrong fella, he had many planes and he flew lots. He did have a bit of an eccentric bend to him. He was known to carry a loaded shotgun when he would go in his plane with him. The reason why he did this is because there was a crash of this guy, Lieutenant Myrtle, that they talked about at the beginning. He was found with his head torn from his body in the crash. His body was in, it was fine. Well, I mean, you know, minus the head. Armstrong thought that this was really bizarre, that somebody could have their head ripped off and their body would be fine in a crash. Like, it just didn't make any sense to him. It seemed really suspicious. And he's vague at this point in his journal about his suspicions.
Right. And I knew this was going to be a monster story from that patent thing that we heard earlier, blah, blah, blah. The guy's head totally missing after having some kind of crash landing, it didn't actually seem that suspicious to me.
Yeah. When I was thinking about it, I thought, like, if the plane landed in a certain way, it could shear your head off of your body. I didn't think it would be that nutty. But the head wasn't found? Is that true? Was that in the story? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, the head is just completely gone.
So maybe that's a little weird.
I think the point is it's an injury that shouldn't have happened.
Right. Now we get into the notebook, and this is a found text kind of thing. So pretty much the rest of the story is this Armstrong fella accounting what he got into, basically.
And it's what we're used to dealing with here, where we're going to get, you know, somebody's journal, somebody's firsthand account. But Doyle does a really amazing thing here to make it a little sensory, in that the first couple of pages are missing and the last page is missing.
Mm-hmm.
He says, with these essential explanations, I will now give the narrative exactly as it stands, beginning at page 3 of the blood-soaked notebook.
Yeah.
I feel like when you're reading the story from here on out, you can kind of feel those pages in your hands. They're dirty. They've been wrecked. Yeah. He does a thing to kind of make this narrative a little more sensory. And I think that's what makes him such a good writer.
Yeah.
He knows to do that.
But he also got paid by the word, it seems, in the story, because Armstrong talks a lot. So Armstrong is having dinner with some pals, talking about the dangers of flying up really high. Thin air, the cold, all that jazz. He talks about in the old days of flight, how they couldn't get up very high, but now with the new, more powerful engines, they're breaking new ground. Some have gone high up into the sky and were fine. Others have met horrible fates. Why is this? Well, Armstrong gives the analogy of Earth. You can land all over Earth, any place, and probably be safe. But in some places, if you land, there's tigers. Perhaps in the air, there are jungles of the upper atmosphere. Two of these particularly dangerous areas he's figured out are in France, and the other one is in England, near Wiltshire and Kent.
That makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah, if you land in a place where there's hyenas and wolves, you're going to get killed. The world is vast, and so the upper air must be vast as well. At the time this was written, we hadn't really investigated even that level of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really understand why this would be an interesting story to somebody at the time. But I guess right now it seems silly because we get on flights all the time.
Sure. But it's a really neat idea to think that there is a whole other world up in the sky that we don't really know or understand. And I can see how that would be a room. It's something that hasn't occurred to me because we have explored it as much as humans have. Explored it as pretty much as much as you possibly can. But the idea that, of course, there might be something like this. I'm jumping ahead a little bit because there's monsters, obviously.
Yeah.
He talks about these jungles of the air a lot. That's kind of his theory that he's going on. And he says that some of these missing planes or people that have crashed, a lot of people say they went into the sea. Of course, they're never found. Or that a plane was found and there's no body. And they think, oh, well, he must have gotten thrown from the plane and who knows where his body, maybe that ended up in the water. This guy Baxter had someone watch his plane go down. This is a story that Armstrong's telling through a telescope. And he saw the plane go up as if it was jerked from its descent in a very unnatural way. And then there's also this guy Connor who crashed but died before his plane crashed. And they think that he died of fright.
Can you really die of fright? Has that ever been on a death certificate?
I don't think so. Maybe have a heart attack.
I don't care what actually happened. I know it'll probably say renal failure or, you know, cardiovascular event.
Sure,
but
yeah.
But please, I'm going to put it in my will that on my death certificate, I just wanted to say fright.
That would be pretty good. Well, what also I thought was a little odd about this is that if your plane is crashing, wouldn't you kind of be scared?
Exactly. Like,
when you die of fright, maybe because you're freaking really scared that you're falling to your death?
No, it must have been a monster.
So back to this guy Myrtle who had his head ripped off. No way that happened in a crash. This is what Armstrong is saying. His body was also covered with this weird grease, which no one could identify. He believed that this place in high altitude this air jungle is up there. Is it dangerous? And there are things living up there, and he wants to explore it. This is the part of the story where I started tuning out, basically, because he just goes into heaps and heaps of detail about the plane that he's using for the job, lots of description, and I'm just not really into the nuance of planes.
It's a little like At the Mountains of Madness, where he goes into so much detail about the provisions they're taking and the preparations that they're making. I actually was reading this really early in the morning because my neighbors were making a lot of noise upstairs. It woken me up at like 5 a.m. You know, so I read a little bit. This was the part where I fell asleep, woke up again. Yep, still reading this. You know, but this was the part. Put me to bed.
I'm going to skim because it's really long. There's a lot of it. He talks about how important it is to go up slowly, go up for a bit, fly around, get used to the atmosphere, then climb a little bit higher. It's a warm day in September, but rain seems to be threatening. He was able to get above the hailstorm, but it's still rainy and he's worried about his canvas plane getting too wet and heavy.
And you can kind of get this sense that it, you know, flight is still wondrous to people at this time. The fact that he's describing what the building materials are for the plane. I don't think people feel that way anymore about flight, as we were just saying. It's just an easy thing.
So he looks down below him and he sees birds flying below him. He doesn't know what kind of birds they are because, you know, he's not a zoologist. So he's flying around. I had a sense as to where this was going.
Yeah.
You know, that there was going to be some monsters up there. So I just really wanted him to get to the monsters.
Yeah, I did too. So much. So much.
He said he really hoped that the air would be calm up high, but when he got there, it was still windy. By his calculations, he was in this air jungle. He finally got up to where he wanted to be, 19,000 feet by noon. He finds that there's this river of air that he glides into, that it's smooth. There are all these little whirlpools around that of air, kind of these little spinny, winny things, these cones that he gets caught into, pulls him down, and he almost loses it, but he's awesome, so he's able to pull himself out of these air pocket thingies.
I'll say this, the narrator is very much like a pilot in that he brags about himself constantly.
There's a lot of bragging going on here.
And I think that's common among all pioneers that have tried to fly planes, that have broken the sound barrier, that have gone into space.
Sure.
At the end of the day, they really are like, I am awesome. They really are true Beowulfs. They're true heroes. They really are like, nothing can defeat me, and I'm going to go ahead and do this. I really, you know, those men are out there.
Sure. Well, I mean, and they are doing really crazy, dangerous stuff. So I think it takes a certain kind of person to go, you know what, I'm going to F all this easy stuff, and I'm going to go put my life on the line for maybe nothing.
I'm so glad they're out there so I can observe them.
Yep, me too. He pulls it together and he continues to go up higher. He has an oxygen bag and he's dressed really warm. He did say that since his ascent was so gradual that he didn't even really need the oxygen.
Well, he's bragging about how awesome he is.
Yeah, he's
too awesome. Brought oxygen, but he was so clever in the way that he flies up. His body gets used to it as he's going.
So by 1:30, he's 7 miles high and still climbing. Temperature is zero. He's having some problems with one of his spark plugs and he's worried about it failing. And then something happens. He says, something whizzed past me in a trail of smoke and exploded with a loud hissing sound, sending forth a cloud of steam. And he thinks it might be a meteor shower. And then a few other things whizzed past him.
Then I remembered that the Earth is forever being bombarded by meteor stones and would be hardly inhabitable were they not in nearly every case turned to vapor in the outer layers of the atmosphere. So the idea is here that like stones and fragments of planets are constantly bombarding the Earth, but they're being evaporated in those upper layers.
Yep.
Which I don't know if that's true at all, but it sounds really cool.
It's true. It is true. I just don't know how frequent it is, and I don't know if they would explode up where he is. I have no specifics of it, but I'm for sure, definitely lots of debris comes flying at us, but most of it burns up.
I love the idea that the Earth is just protecting us. You know, Gaia is here getting it done, taking care of those meteors that are trying to kill us all.
Now reaching the 40,000 foot mark, and he is as high as he's going to be able to get. He actually lets the plane guide itself a bit, and he gets his binoculars, and he's just looking around, trying to figure out if there's any predator things nearby that might be hiding. So he decides if they're hiding and waiting for him, then he needs to kind of draw them out. So he just kind of flies around this air jungle area. He only has an hour's worth of gas left, but he's not worried because his plane could glide him down. And he's confident he can do that. Around him, it wasn't clear anymore. There are these strange wisps of smoke twirling around. And he flew through one of them and they left this oily residue. It wasn't alive, but it seemed organic to him. And he thinks, well, maybe this stuff is some food, maybe for some kind of creature that lives up here. Or was it poo? Which is what I was thinking. I go, did he just go through some air monster poo? He then looks up and he sees something amazing.
Conceive a jellyfish such as sails in our summer seas, bell-shaped and of enormous size. Far larger, I should judge, than the Dome of St. Paul's. It was of a light pink color, veined with a delicate green, but the whole huge fabric so tenuous that it was but a fairy outline against the dark blue sky. It pulsated with a delicate and regular rhythm. From it there depended two long, drooping green tentacles which swayed slowly backwards and forwards. This gorgeous vision passed gently with noiseless dignity over my head, as light and fragile as a soap bubble, and drifted upon its stately way.
He moves his plane around to get a better look at this thing, but he sees that there are hundreds of these things, all different sizes, just floating around.
Where do you think he got this from? Was it some study of underseas?
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. They sound like, well, jellyfish, really.
Yeah.
And that's the way that they float in the water, so he just goes, well, what if something could float like that in the air?
That's what I thought too. Mystery solved.
But then there's something else. These serpent-like creatures made of vapor-like material. They are like 20 or 30 feet long. He says, a very light gray or smoke color with some darker lines within, which gave the impression of a definite organism.
It's a little like From Beyond.
Yeah.
We've gotten up into this upper atmosphere that people haven't comprehended yet. There are creatures there that don't seem to obey the laws of physics that the rest of us do. They are definitely not mammalian.
These serpent things, though, they move past him, and then there is something else.
But a more terrible experience was in store for me. Floating downwards from a great height, there came a purplish patch of vapor, small as I saw it first, but rapidly enlarging as it approached me, until it appeared to be hundreds of square feet in size. Though fashioned of some transparent jelly-like substance, it was nonetheless of much more definite outline and solid consistence than anything which I had seen before. There were more traces, too, of a physical organization, especially two vast, shadowy, circular plates upon either side, which may have been eyes, and a perfectly solid white projection between them, which was as curved and cruel as the beak of a vulture.
That's some monster-y stuff.
Yeah. It's got like a beak, and it's got these sort of bubble things on top of it.
Yeah.
It's so elastic and gelatinous was it that never for two successive minutes was it the same shape, and yet each change made it more threatening and loathsome than the last.
It's kind of a Shoggoth thing.
But it's got a beak.
Yeah, and eyes.
And eyes.
What we think are eyes.
It had an aggressive attitude and would turn color from kind of this mauve to this dark, angry purple.
Did you say mauve?
Mauve?
No, it's mauve, but I liked it. I liked it when you said that.
Saying mauve. Can I say mauve?
You can, please.
Like I said, on the upper part of its body, it has these three big bubbly things. Armstrong thinks that these things might have some gas in them that keeps the creature afloat. But these things are really fast as well, and they're keeping pace with this plane. He felt this thing was a predator, like the way that it was behaving, and it was after him. So he tried to lose it, but it kept pace with him. He decided to descend, but as he did, a tentacle shot out, trying to grab his plane. As it tries to grab his plane, it grabs his engine, which is hot, and it pulls its tentacle away. And then it goes in for another attack, and this time it hits the propeller blades, and then again, it gets hurt and it pulls back. But the third attack, it grabs Armstrong, and it started to pull him out. He tried to grab it with his fingers, but it felt really strange. He says, my fingers sticking into the smooth, glue-like surface, and for an instant, I disengaged myself, but only to be caught round the boot by another coil.
So he's
pulling himself out of this thing, and it's just dragging him. It keeps grabbing him with these tentacles.
the thing about this story is we're talking about early air flight where you're exposed in the cockpit.
Oh, yeah.
So he's fighting a monster while he's flying a plane.
Yeah.
That's so Han Solo. It's so amazing.
He manages to get his shotgun and give it a blast. And the buckshot would do nothing to a creature of this size.
Yeah.
But he got lucky because his shot hits one of those bubbles on its back and it explodes. And the bubble exploding on its back messes with the creature. It just totally confuses it. It kind of veers off to the side. He just gets out of there with the creature kind of behind him. But he's gone, man. He escapes.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to land, so he did so in a field not too far away. He found a passing motorist who gave him some petrol fly back home. Yeah.
That's how we know you're a German spy. Gas, my friend. Gas.
Gas. Well, he says petrol in the story, for crying
out
loud.
All right.
Now, his plan is to get some proof of these creatures. He's going to try to get one of those iridescent bubble creatures, one of the first ones that he saw. The kind of jellyfish things. He knows there's some risk running into those predators, but he thinks, odds are low.
Right.
Come on, now, how many predators are there up there, really?
Yeah, I could go right into that same space of air and not have any problems. I'll just snatch one.
But the message ends abruptly.
Here, a page of the manuscript is unfortunately missing. On the next page is written in large, straggling writing, 43,000 feet. I shall never see Earth again. They are beneath me, three of them. God help me, it is a dreadful death to die. Such, in its entirety, is the Joyce Armstrong statement. Of the man, nothing has since been seen. Pieces of his shattered monoplane have been picked up in the preserves of Mr. Bud Lushington upon the borders of Kent and Sussex, within a few miles of the spot where the notebook was discovered. If the unfortunate aviator's theory is correct, that this air jungle, as he called it, existed only over the southwest of England, then it would seem that he had fled from it at the full speed of his monoplane, but had been overtaken and devoured by those horrible creatures at some spot in the outer atmosphere above the place where the grim relics were found. The picture of that monoplane skimming down the sky with nameless terrors flying as swiftly beneath it and cutting it off always from the earth while they gradually close in upon their victim is one upon which a man who valued his sanity would prefer not to dwell. There are many, as I am aware, who still jeer at the facts which I have here set down, but even they must admit that Joyce Armstrong has disappeared, and I would commend to them his own words. This notebook may explain what I am trying to do and how I lost my life in doing it, but no drivel about accidents or mysteries, if you please.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end of it. That "you, if you please," is it's capitalized. What is he trying to convey at the end of that story?
I think he's just trying to make the reader feel involved, implicit.
I don't want to hear that I had a heart attack while I was flying. I don't want to hear that there was some natural incident. I'm trying so hard to tell you that there's a monster there, is what I got out of it.
Yeah.
It wasn't an accident.
I think that the story was super cool. It could have been edited down a bunch.
Yeah.
But it's sort of inspiring, this the visual aspect of it, these billowy clouds, you know, like these big, like Patton was saying, you know, flying through those big canyons of clouds sometimes in an airplane, to think of it inhabited by these creatures. It's totally cool.
Absolutely. I mean, it does look like its own little world up there whenever you're above the clouds. But now it's so commonplace.
Yeah, that's not such a big deal. But I think maybe when next time I fly, I'm going to look out there and make myself see some crazy stuff. I'm gonna have
some
to take
jellyfish monsters.
Some hallucinogenics before I get on the plane, but you know.
No, don't do that.
That's what it takes.
That's what it takes. You know what? We have to be really committed to this show and to these ideas and to this story.
Absolutely.
So I think as many mushrooms as we can take, those are things that we would just be doing for our art.
I'm game. So next week, we are doing another grab bag story, a potpourri. It's called Unseen, Unfeared by Francis. I was going to say Fisher Stevens. It's Francis Stevens, not Fisher Stevens, the actor who was once married to Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's right.
But also played a very racist character, the Indian character from the Short Circuit films, which
Oh, he did. That's right. He was in some brown face for those.
Yeah, he browned it up. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
At the time, of course, nothing's. I thought he was Indian when I was a kid, but
he didn't know better.
Well, it's pretty uncomfortable now to watch.
Really?
I gotta say, yeah.
I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Yeah, go just YouTube a little of it, and you'll go, wow. Ha ha. I want to thank our reader, John Hancock, for being so glad
to have you back.
Amazing as always. We haven't had him on the show for a while, and it's good to get him doing some Doyle.
He just makes me feel good.
Yeah, real good. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
HPPodcraft.com.